That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said. Well, that's what she said.
Welcome to That's What She Said, conversations with interesting people from the world of sports, music, comedy, and more, talking about their lives, careers, successes, and failures. Welcome to the latest edition of That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. So excited for you guys to hear the conversation with this week's guest, Kenny Mayne, who was a real inspiration for me when I decided to get into sports. If you're a regular listener, you probably know that I originally moved out to Los Angeles to do comedy and acting, wanted to be on Saturday Night Live. And as I started to look into the possibility of working in sports, my background was always just watching and playing. I hadn't really realized that you could make a living talking about sports, and I wanted to still be an entertainer, and I wanted to still embrace the comedy that I had grown up wanting to pursue. And Kenny Mayne was this perfect example of someone who seemed to be doing both, and his main events inspired me a ton and also taught me some lessons early on about how sarcasm and dry comedy are perceived and received differently between men and women and older people and younger people and all that stuff. And it's something that is still sticks in my craw occasionally. And the example that I often use when talking to people about how it can be difficult trying to be a woman in sports and be funny and make jokes that need someone to be on the other side to get it, right? And not just assume you're an idiot. I often use the example of Kenny Mayne. You know, he can start a SportsCenter clip of the Lakers and say, LeBron James, warming up, never seen him play. I heard he's really good though. And that's funny because everyone knows he's joking. If I started a clip that way myself, there would legitimately be people out there that were like, wow, this girl has never seen LeBron. This is, how did she get her job? Right. And so like the ability to be able to play in the way that he does has always been something I admired because he's great at it. And I was also a little jealous of because I haven't yet gotten to the point where I can do it so freely. But I want to play you guys a quick clip because when I was just starting out in LA and I made my hosting reel, which was literally, I had to buy a DVD burner. This was before you could just send everything digitally and make CDs and DVDs of this to send along to talent agencies and for auditions. And this is a little clip from that hosting reel that I called the Spain event.
Hi, I'm Sarah Spain. And today we're going to talk about an issue that's gone widely undiscussed in the NBA this season. Oh, sure, they've changed the ball from leather to synthetic to agree with animal rights activists. But has anyone talked about how many trees are murdered each year to make hardwood floors? This and so much more on the Spain event.
Now, presumably, everyone who knows me now knows that that's a joke, and presumably and hopefully everybody who received one of those DVDs was familiar with the main event and familiar with the comedy that I was aiming for there. But that's how much Kenny Mayne kind of inspired me coming up, was this desire to be able to play the way that he does and still respect sports, but understand that it's entertainment and there's so much fun to be had while covering it. So anyway, you guys are going to love this conversation. He's the best. Here's my interview with Kenny Mayne.
That's what she said.
Super excited to welcome in this week's guest, an idol of mine, really, an inspiration of mine when I got into this career. Maybe not as much anymore now that I know him better, but still, of course, someone I admire very much. ESPN SportsCenter anchor, feature reporter, general do-everything guy who's held almost every position at the company, Kenny Mayne. The idol stuff is real, but I think the first time I met you at some Super Bowl radio role, I said the same thing. How many Super Bowls have you been to, by the way? I was trying to see if you would remember that.
I don't know the exact number, but many. But I remember our first meeting because your name stood out.
You
and
do?
Yes, you came up to me and tried to get me to be in whatever little thing you were doing. I don't remember what the subject was. They were similar to all mine where we just made them up as we went along.
Right.
But yes, I remember the meeting. I think it was, it's probably near Radio Row. I want to say it was in Phoenix, but it might not have been.
It might have been,
But yeah, you came up and then I did something for you, whatever that was. That's kind of how I always did all of mine. I'd just pretty much go up to people and ask favors, and you can't worry about getting no's. You
speak
for the yeses.
Cross your fingers.
We're just looking back at one of our ridiculous fake football stories back when I used to do those for Countdown. We were in Phoenix, and we kind of, like, our story fell through. And in the meantime, Tony Sirico, who played Paulie Walnuts on The Sopranos,
right,
called me up on the phone. He had just done me a couple of favors. He'd been in a couple of bits for me. And he's like, hey, kid, I need 4 Super Bowl tickets. I'm like, yeah, they're, y'all try. Definitely. I'll give it the effort. And in my head, I'm like, there's zero, you know, it's Monday of Super Bowl week. Like, you know, we don't have a vending machine of Super Bowl tickets. But he hangs up, and I have every belief that, you know, pretty much I've been threatened that I have to get him Super Bowl tickets. So we decided, let's just make that our story this week, that Paulie Walnuts is threatening me that I need to get him 4 Super Bowl tickets. So the whole week I went around town trying to find anybody, like I'm raising 4 fingers up when Belichick's doing his press conference, and I'm going up to the players, and just, it's all ridiculous. In the end, we blew up a car in the desert, and we had I think the correct version, he calls himself midget actor on his website, but small people.
Right, little person.
Yes, Mark Trambino, actor. And, yeah, for some reason, the two of us in a car that we blew up in the desert and Dave Craig on a horse, that was the that was the big finish.
Sports.
Look it up on the internet.
Well, one of my favorite main events was with, you know, the Bears' Robbie Gould after that kick in the wind in San Francisco. The bit about him just turning every single kick into a 90-degree angle since he was a kid. Some of them are just so smart. Are we ever going to get any more main events?
Well, they're case by case. I'm on sort of a new contract where they want me doing SportsCenter specifically, not exclusively, but almost. And so anytime I do something extra, there's sort of a surcharge going on or something. And
right. Better be worth it then.
I haven't done many.
Yeah.
However, I'm in the middle of a really fun one. One of my favorite guys ever, Jared Allen, the famous tackler of the NFL fame, and they do his calf roping thing. What stood out for people who don't remember him as well, you should, because he was like all pro every year. he always used to say on the player introductions that he went to Culinary Academy.
Yes.
When the other guys would, you know, say University of whatever. Just a funny guy. Funny, smart, silly, and good, just a solid guy. And he is now trying to be a curler, and his ambition is to make the Olympics next time around. And somehow he talked some of his ex-football playing friends into joining his curling team as well. And it's all pretty ridiculous. But
this will be good. This will be good.
No, but they are dead serious.
They have an actual former Olympic curler on their team who's technically, I think, like an emergency guy, but he's basically coaching them, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know if they're really going to succeed, but he and the guy, I mean, they got nothing else to do. They made their money in football. And,
right.
You know, they're
and he's got personalities. So make a documentary at least, right? Film it as you go. So make it worth our while.
It'll be on, what it is, late January. It'll be on sometime in February.
So awesome.
That's my latest sort of main event thing. But, yeah, for many, many years, we did the pretty much every week, let's make up something ridiculous and stick it on TV. But now I do partial scores of the Sacramento Kings and the Clippers.
Right, exactly. The good stuff.
And other important things, too.
Yeah. All right, let's go to the beginning. That's where I start these. What did you want to be when you were a kid?
Well, fleeting moment, an astronaut.
Uh-huh.
I'm old. I grew up in the whole, you know, road to the moon, you know, thing that was going on back then. And we really did get to the moon.
Wow, no way. I should look into this.
But, no, very early on, you know, probably late grade school, junior high for sure, I wanted to do something in journalism, writing documentaries, Mr. Middle East correspondent, something, you know, related to that. I didn't know what it was going to be, but I directed pretty much everything, especially, you know, once I got to college. And then as I got my first job in TV, I was like local news reporter after I finally got the chance to be on the air. And I really had no interest in doing sports.
Hmm.
But then our little station in Seattle, Tacoma, only did news Monday through Friday. Our motto was, if there's news on the weekends, it's news to us. That was like an inside
nice.
Joke. But they added weekends, and the guy that was in charge, Jack Eddy, says, hey, you played football. You be the sports guy. So I started doing Husky games and Seahawks and the Mariners, and all of that just, you know, was more fun than going to city council meetings
right.
and falling asleep. And I just shifted. So, yeah, even though I have a strong interest still in political things and international news and what's going on with our country, you know, I ended up making my living doing sports, which I also love as well, having grown up in it. But my original intention was not to do sports, but to do more straighter news or documentaries.
Yeah, so you were a high school quarterback in Washington. You were the backup quarterback at UNLV, where you got a broadcasting degree. And then you were a free agent for the Seahawks. How long did the Seahawks stint last?
As many as 24 hours did that year. No, about 3 weeks. Because what happened was the kid who played ahead of me, Sam King, and if you need insurance in the greater Las Vegas region, go to Sam King. Good guy, still a friend.
I just might.
He led the nation in passing yards, so I played behind a pretty good quarterback. And he got an offer to go to the Seahawks, but he turned it down. He was going to go to Canada. Then he had some other issues, like passing the physical himself. So he really never got to succeed in the pros, even though he had the talent to do so. But my coach then called the Seahawks and said, hey, if you like the first guy, you should look at the guy that was his backup. At least give him a look. So I went up and threw in Seattle, and it was like a private throwing thing. It was just me and a couple of receivers. One of them happened to be Steve Largent. So he happened to be in the building, and they're, hey, we need a receiver out there. And he volunteered to come out and catch some balls off his shoes. So that was helpful. So I signed pretty much a half hour later, whatever they put in front of me, pretty much same way I signed my first ESPN deal. Didn't really read it, just, oh, really? I get to join this? I'm in. You know? So I threw in their pre-camp for a couple few weeks, and then when the real camp started over in Cheney, Washington at the time, the very first day they brought me in and put me on this machine that I thought it was just like another test, you know, like running a 40 or doing the
right
bench or whatever. Instead, it was a specific test specifically for me to find out if they want to even keep me around at all, and the doctors just wouldn't clear me. They thought my ankle sucked so bad they were like, we're not going to take a risk on a marginal player and have him get hurt on day one. So I tried for a couple more years, though. I tried a couple CFL tryouts, USFL, and I guess my paperwork wasn't outstanding. You know, the fact I was only second string in college and got a ruined ankle. So that,
right,
those weren't good.
That'll slow you down.
I tried to hide those down at the bottom of the – but I'm still playing at my age, but now just recreationally I get to play.
Yeah.
I'm at the Pearl Jam team flag football game every year. They raise money for Crohn's.
That's
colitis.
Amazing.
Mike McCready, the guitarist, deals with
that's
that.
That's awesome.
And he's done this really cool thing for a number of years where we play at CenturyLink. And then I still play with some veterans, and in fact, we're going to get to play a game Super Bowl week.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in a minute. I wanted to ask you, so, you know, I heard in another podcast you talked about how your parents were very invested early on in, you know, the kids sitting in front of the television and talking about current events, and you said that early on you were more interested in politics and news than sports. Did you have the same personality that you have now that everybody knows when you were a jock in high school and in college? Because there aren't a lot of athletes that anyone gets to cover that are dry and sarcastic and sort of sardonic. Were you always like this, or is this more of an acquired personality once you got out of the straight sports life?
I think I've always been the same. I might have refined how I deliver it a little better through the years, I guess would be the closest thing to compare with. Because, like, when I was doing local sports here, you know, we did things like I had a lab, little pet lab, Labrador, black lab, and I had him chew on a baseball, and then we shot like a really tight shot of him, and we would roll the scores over him eating a baseball and called it the dog days of summer scoreboard. So, like,
nice.
I was experimenting, trying hopefully different things, but certainly I've hopefully polished my delivery of it. But I think I was just the same, just kind of you're shaped by, my dad was a really funny guy, he had funny friends, and my best friend Mark is the funniest guy I know. You know, my sister's boyfriends, like, what, I have a lot of different influences. Staying up to watch Johnny Carson at 11:30 was a big deal. You know, that you didn't want to miss his monologue. So
right,
you're definitely shaped by who's around you, and you turn out to be whatever the hell you are. I still think, I think about the same as when I was 7 or 8 years old. I don't honestly, like, have I matured at all? Like, I pay bills on time. Other than that, I think I'm still, you know, I just see situations and I kind of look, what's the most abstract thing to say right now? Or what's the weirdest view of what is going on? Because I'm sort of bored by common day experience.
Right.
You know, sometimes
that's
I'll be a Christian. My wife will be like, whatever. We'll be at Home Goods checkout, you know, like on a Wednesday. And I'll look at her and say, this is why God created it right here. This Home Goods checkout
line. Life's all about.
This is why we were invented. So, yeah, I think I've always had sort of a queer look at reality. You know, like just kind of bored with convention. So I'm not trying to be unconventional. I just think I kind of am.
Yeah.
And well, so I'm able to express that.
Yeah. It's interesting because I'm picturing it as an actual news reporter, and instead I don't know why I'm conjuring up images of the Saturday Night Live character that keeps like dying on air, but then comes back to life and shoves the mic at people's faces. Like, I don't know, like you just not being able to keep a straight face or report straight, but you did news, right? Out of after football, before in Vegas and Seattle, before moving to sports.
Yeah. I mean, my first quote unquote TV job was for the PBS station in Las Vegas. It was the once a week. You know that really boring thing that's on PBS, like at 3 in the afternoon on a Sunday, you know, the community affairs type show? And Lee Winston, God love him, he gave me this job as his reporter. So I would do the serious story setting up, you know, let's see the story now. Let's have the conversation with the community leaders. And absolutely, I took it dead serious. So I think I always said when I take serious things seriously, and pretty much everything else, not so much. So
yeah.
Most of it's not so much. But, yeah, when I was doing real news, like in Seattle, you know, I did stories on the Green River Killer, and we did stories on whatever, you know, local fires, accidents, you know, like regular straight stories that you see on local news. And I think I always had in my pocket, though, my silly side, but I just didn't obviously bring that into those things.
Well, you can do both, and it's frustrating at times for myself as well when people think if you are one, you can't do the other. That's a very simplistic way of approaching human beings.
Agreed.
No, it can be frustrating.
Thing happens on SportsCenter for sure. Like on a particular night, we might have two or three real serious things, whatever an investigation of a college or a player's done wrong or allegedly done wrong. And so we handle those things appropriately. But then, you know, 80% the rest of the show is people dunking on each other and us making up silly things to say as they do so. So, hopefully, you know, you handle yourself appropriately when called upon.
Right.
But, yeah, it probably is strange to see some of the stuff I have done and say, how could he have ever, you know, had this fascination with real news or serious things? But
yeah.
I guess you'd have to hear me impart my words on such a story, and then you might know.
That's right. That's true. So you joined ESPN in 94. You've told the story before about, you know, sending John Walsh a note was very similar to the old, will you go out with me? Check yes, check no. But it was, will you give me a job at ESPN? Yes, no, keep doing freelance, or yes, but not till there's an ESPN 5. It worked for whatever reason. You got the job. And is it right that you started on RPM tonight?
It is incorrect. First job I had was when they started ESPN2, they had a show called Sports Night, and it was supposed to just be the hipper version of SportsCenter, you know?
That's where the Oberman leather jacket came into play, I think.
Exactly.
Yes.
So the whole chronology, I had been interviewed way back. Remember anybody old enough to remember Joe Montana to John Taylor for the 49ers to beat the Bengals in the Super Bowl? Same one where Joe Montana said, look, there's John Candy on the sideline. So this was 1989. I did what I thought was a pretty decent Sunday night sports on my little Channel 11 back then, and I sent that to ESPN. They brought me back for an interview, but then they started asking questions like, what do I think about the Cubs middle relief or something? I was like, they'll come in after the starters for sure.
And before the closer, I'm guessing.
They'll be the setup guy and then the closer, yeah. So I didn't have a very good answer. They wanted me to be a bigger sports nerd than I was or even am. And didn't get hired, but they kind of kept me in mind. I, for some reason, quit that job about 6 months later, and I went through like 4 years of I was working sales jobs. I assembled garbage cans. I did a whole bunch of things to pay the bills while I continued to freelance in TV. And they brought me back a couple more times for interviews. So by the time they brought me back for the third go around, ESPN2 had now started. It had been up about 6 months or so. And remember Keith, as you said, in the leather jacket, he went back to one to be with Dan on the 11, and Stuart Scott moved up from the lesser role called the smash person. You came on at the top of the hour for a couple minutes, And so now they needed one more person, and that was me. So I remember distinctly Vince Doria, who's no longer with ESPN, great guy. He was my first boss. I just flat out, I'm one of those people who likes to tell people the reasons they don't want me and try to defeat the objections up front, as opposed to hoping that I said, Vince, I still don't know who the hell the fifth pitcher on the Cubs is, and I really don't care. But if you tell me to do a story on the son of a bitch, it'll be your best story you got. And he's like, that's a pretty good answer.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Somehow I got hired.
I never had to take the quiz, thankfully. That always sounded scary when people would talk about the quiz. So,
oh, yeah.
I'm glad I avoided that. All right, so Sports Night, RPM tonight, Sports Center, Main Street, Wider World of Sports, horse racing, golf, football. I mean, literally everything. I want to go back to Main Street quickly because, unfortunately, I never watched it. I don't know what I was doing with my life at the time. I know, because I looked it up when I was doing some research. I was like, this show had Aubrey Plaza on it, and it was like very, you know, satirical, funny, staged look at sports. And how long did that run for? And was that something that you liked because it was not just sports plus comedy, but it was full on acted and not just inserting funny quips along with the regular protocol for sports reporting?
Yeah, no, I mean, definitely the thrill of it was getting to do, like, I love doing commercial work, which I do occasionally still, and you really are kind of like taking a role, like not that I think I'm Leo DiCaprio or anything, but I usually think I do halfway okay on those things where they give you either the script or a shell of it, and then you get to kind of do your own thing, and that's very much what this one was. But yeah, everybody. You mentioned Aubrey. There was also Alison Becker, John Glazer, Ben Schwartz, John Mulaney was in a couple.
Wow.
Chris Smith. Like, our list is Lenny Jacobson, who did some good work with, why am I forgetting her name? She was on Sopranos. She played the wife. She had Nurse Jackie.
Yeah.
So everybody, in fact, I just saw John Glazer at a Seattle comedy show last week. I helped open it for him. And have remained friends with all those people. All of them went on and, like, took over Hollywood, and I'm still doing Diamondbacks, Rockies partials, but I'm still happy with what I'm doing. But, yeah, it was really fun. It was on a couple years, and I think we did what we called three seasons, you know, of eight episodes or whatever they were. But those were fun, and you could argue we were kind of doing that. 2008, I think, is when it started, the kind of stuff that you'd think we want right now, given all this push for things online and ESPN Plus and so forth. So
bring it back. It's been long enough. You know, we're bringing back Murphy Brown. We're bringing back a Magnum PI, right? I think it's time. It feels right.
I'm in
too. I've just invited myself. I know I wasn't invited, but I've invited
myself.
Wider World of Sports is essentially a dream job. This series basically sent you around the world to amazing things like canal jumping in the Netherlands and a crazy horse race in the middle of a town in Italy. That one was particularly fascinating. Something called Hornussen in Switzerland. I mean, this was finding the world of sports. And what was this actually like in practice? Is it as dream of a job as it would seem, just looking at it on paper and watching what the product is after the fact?
100%. What happened was I heard they were going to kill Main Street without really a firm reason as to why, but I just knew this was about to go down. So I went in and said, in my contract at the time, I was supposed to do X amount of this and X amount of that, and I didn't want the portion of what I was supposed to do for ESPN.com to have them just blindly assign me, you're now going to be covering blank. So dreamed up this little idea. We're going to take the old Wide World of Sports, like they ran on ABC way back when. We're going to add an R. We'll call it Wider World of Sports, and we'll call it our own. And somehow they agreed in, like, one meeting. And then crazier than that, not long after agreeing, yes, we're going to do this, and we'll figure out when the rollout is, they got a hold of us. Excuse me. They got a hold of us, my producer and I, and said, hey, we need an episode or two really quick, because the upfronts, which is the big rollout of, you know, new programming for the advertisers, is coming up in like a month, and we want to be able to show that at the upfronts. So we literally planned one in like 3 days. So we just decided, let's stick with an English-speaking country, make sure we get something that makes sense. Pretty much bought flights to London, ended up going to Ireland as well. And, yeah, there we were. We were flying around the world just covering the initial – conception of it was, let's go to other countries and find out unique sports that they're doing in a lot of cases that either we've heard of but don't know much about, or we've never heard of and know nothing about. And we ended up finding a real cool mix of them over the next couple few years. So like you said, the Palio is what you're talking about in Italy, the horse race.
Yeah, we were there. That's insane.
We were in Italy for like 2 weeks, and we weren't there screwing around. Like every day we were up early and shooting late, like really getting to know what the subject was and what the people were about. One of my other favorites was Irish road bowling. They take an iron ball and throw it down a street, and then the other guy throws, and the other guy throws, sort of like golf rules, who's ever away. And it was just amazing. Like, these two towns would come together and watch two men throw an iron ball a mile and a quarter, and whoever threw it the least number of times won. What's some other crazy one we did? We went to Nicaragua, and we surfed down a volcano on a plastic board, sort of like, you know, every kid has done, either with cardboard or a stolen school lunch tray, you know, like just sliding down a hill.
Yeah.
Went to Thailand. We did elephant polo. The Hornussen you were speaking of from Switzerland, that's like these people take what looks like a golf club, but it's much longer and it kind of bends, and they hit this triangular metal thing called a hornet, and then other people stand in the field with a giant cheese board is what it looks like and try to knock it down. So everywhere around the world, people are doing ridiculous things because maybe they got bored in the year 1600 and needed something to do, you know. But we tried to find, you know, like, handled them seriously when they were serious, like the one in Bosnia was very serious, and handled them in a silly way when it was kind of a silly sport. The one in Bosnia was crazy. It was a bridge that got blown up during the Bosnian, the breakup of Yugoslavia, the war there, and they used to dive off it as a competition for hundreds of years, and now they no longer had their bridge. So getting their bridge back and restoring this tradition that they had was a huge deal, very emotional. And that one, there wasn't one joke. You know, the whole thing was like a real serious documentary about this town and Mostar and how they put it back together. Some of the others we took slightly less seriously. We ran into a guy selling ice cream in Thailand. We made a story out of that because his song sounded like Beyonce and Pokemon had a child and made music. It was great fun. It seems like every fun thing I've done, it lasts a couple few years, and then somebody gets bored and we move on to something else. But
What I wanted to ask you about. Like, so how do you decide what drives your next contract or your next direction? Because you've done so many things, and you are in a position where you have a lot of say, I would assume, in what you want to do and what they want to use you for. So is it about money? Is it about location? Is it about time of day or how much time it requires? The sport it's about? Happiness? What drives you as you decide what you're doing next with the company or you make these contracts?
Wish I had as much power as you feel I do. But it's all, you know, they've all been different. And it's all oftentimes related to what's going on, you know, the direction ESPN wants to go, and do they want more of this or less of that. And so I've enjoyed all of it. Like, I've tried to always taught my daughters, like, be happy for what you have and not be upset or complaining about what you don't have or what you didn't get. So really I should follow that model myself, because it's almost 25 years now, and I really have done a little bit of everything, and most all of it I've enjoyed a great deal. So who knows what's next? I'm on a contract for a little while longer to do mostly just SportsCenter, and that's fun. I love doing the live show, and the immediacy of what we're doing is a blast. Staying up till 2 and 2:30 in the morning sometimes is less fun, but it kind of comes with the deal, right? Like, the games end late, and you go on the air, and somebody slips you a piece of paper, and Steph Curry just hit a three, and that, I still get a thrill out of that. Like, it still really is fun, the immediacy of what we do and the live performance. But I also like doing all these tape things where you go out and spend time and do something, you know, a little longer length. So who knows? I'm trying to figure it out myself.
What's your week like right now? Because I know you split time between Seattle and Connecticut, and you do have late shifts. How do you stay alive in those different time zones and different times? And how do you, I mean, you've only been married for a short time. You've got this, you know, the newlywed life and everything else. What's the average like? How do you balance this stuff?
Our love is that strong. Just feed off it. I don't know. I'm on an airplane a lot. Like I say, I'm always missing someone and I'm always home. So I kind of live in two places at once. And sometimes my wife comes out west and hangs out here with my daughter, who's a high school senior, and I. And other times I'm just out here with her. Tomorrow I'm flying. Well, tomorrow is now yesterday.
Yep.
When you look at the
well done.
Picture of podcasting. Today, let's just tell them the truth. Isn't today Monday, really, in real life?
Today is Monday. People will be listening to this Tuesday or maybe 3 years from now.
Oh.
Can you figure that out, too?
On Tuesday of real life, I'm flying to
2019.
Atlanta. Okay. And I'm going to play in a football game Wednesday night. And then on Thursday, I'm going to do some Radio Row silly stuff, talking to people and selling products. And then I go up to Connecticut and I start doing sports centers again. I don't know. I think the day one, either direction, is always a little tough. You know, you catch up on your sleep or you go to sleep early or whatever the case. But I have few complaints, especially given everything going on in our world. These other people who were being asked to fly me and keep me safe for no money for the last month. I really try not to complain about, you know, anything.
The miracle of flight.
Seems difficult. Yeah.
Right.
No, I meant more the TSA. And
right. But I mean, yeah, most of us complain about the miracle of flight because we're annoyed with something being delayed or whatever. But that's the more important part of it. Yeah.
No, it is really funny when you see people on Twitter complaining about their particular flight. And when you're in that moment, you really feel like the world can empathize with you.
Yeah, you do. Like, it annoys you when it's someone else and when it's you. I'm like, I have to share.
Yeah. And you're like, dude, like, be happy you're safe and you'll probably get there and you have to change your plans a little bit. Like,
right.
I think I have a decent perspective on things that way. But certainly, I wake up sometimes grumpy and like, oh, my God, I work till what time and I have to go back at what time. But. That's true with any job. No matter what you do for a living, there's always little inside things that, you know, are troublesome. But all in all, I'm pretty happy getting to do what I do, and got daughters, one in college and one picking a college. I just went to Arizona with her for 2 days. We looked at Arizona State and University of Arizona on the same trip. We drove all around Arizona for a couple of days.
That'll be fun.
And she's going to make a good pick hopefully soon, and then they'll both be out and being real adults.
You mentioned you have a football game out in Atlanta. This is for your runfreely.org foundation?
No. It's related, and I can explain. But no, I was asked to play with some veterans like five or 6 years ago at the Super Bowl, like the Wednesday or Thursday of the Super Bowl week. And almost everybody out there is either missing an arm or a leg or both or has some disability on the veteran side. And then we're playing against ex-NFL players. And it's a really competitive and fun flag football game. And I've kind of stayed with this group of people for now all these years. And we played two or three times a year. So
that's awesome.
Separate from that, my wife and I started a foundation called runfreely.org, which you mentioned. They're unrelated. I just happen to be involved in both. So the football thing is there's no cause other than to do it. You know, people are always, what are you raising money for? And like, now we're just playing football, letting everybody be normal for a night and hanging out. And some of the veterans get to meet these NFL stars they might have admired. And in reverse, the players are kind of like blown away, like, you know, showing kind of respect they should show for the veterans and what they've done and how they get out there and do it, you know. But it's not, as one of my friends involved says, it's not like pet a soldier. That's a little inside joke they have. Like, they don't want to be patronized. Like treat them like men and women. And many of them are out doing great other things, you know. So what? They're missing a leg. They're missing an arm. Whatever. They already know they have that day to day, and they go on with their life in a real fruitful way. So this is just like a cool night to get to do something. Most of them grew up playing, or at least, you know, liking football, and for one night they're on the field with ex NFL players. It's a really fun game. And we usually get pretty decent crowds. The one in Atlanta, as you stall for time. Everyone just take a breath because this has been so intense. We don't want to blow people away with it. Hang on. It's coming up. It's what I tell you was the XL Center.
XL Sports World in Fairburn, Georgia.
Bam. XL Sports World, 1245 Oakley Industrial Boulevard, Fairburn, Fairburn, Georgia. And that's this Wednesday, the 30th at 6 o'clock. Game will probably start 6:30-ish, but, you know. Get
awesome.
There early.
So if people are in Atlanta,
really
they can go check it out.
Almost everybody who goes, I've never heard somebody complain. Like, everybody gets something out of it.
Yeah,
you know,
that's great.
The fans get to relate to the NFL guys and the vets, and there's just like this real commonality that goes on, and it's a fun game. The Run Freely thing is an organization Gretchen and I started to benefit soldiers who were injured, and we're trying to help them keep their leg and get to move around better and walk and run without pain. Because I got this brace about a year ago, and it just changed my life. Like, I can play in this game, and I can hike, and I can I wore it to the Pearl Jam concert because I knew I'd be on my feet for 5 hours. Like, it just takes all the pain away. Yeah. And so we quickly started a foundation. We've done a little fundraising, and we're up to number 6 is about to get installed here shortly. And we've raised enough just in, what's it been, like 5 months, truly. You know, that's pretty remarkable how a lot of strangers and friends and family have just all kind of pulled together. Big-time athletes have helped out, Jamal Crawford, Gary Payton, Steve Largent.
That's awesome.
I just left out somebody. Lenny Wilkins was there.
And yeah, you post about that a lot on social media, and obviously you are invested in causes for veterans. This stems from your nephew, correct? That's how you first got involved in veteran causes?
Well, a little bit. I mean, I think I was already inclined to begin with, but yeah, we lost my nephew, Kyle Farr. He came back after serving in the Army over in Iraq, and he was dealing with a lot of things afterward, as many do. Went through the whole VA program in order to try to get well, and ended up dying, like, literally the first night they let him go. He went out drinking with some friends, and his drugs didn't mix with their drugs, and we lost him at a really young age. He was only 27. So my sister, Leslie, started a foundation in Gig Harbor, Washington. It's called Permission to Start Dreaming. They took PTSD and flipped the words.
Yeah.
And they do a running race and a golf tournament and some other fundraisers, and they're helping get veterans put into programs that'll just benefit them. Everything, there's one called Growing Veterans. They go out and they farm together, and there's mountain climbing and filmmaking, horses, dogs. You know, there's all sorts of non-drug things that are beneficial to soldiers to try to get them a little well and, you know, readjust to being a civilian again or being a retired military. So they've been doing good stuff all along. And when I got my brace, it was really less connected to that than just, I just felt kind of a debt. Like, I cried for like 2 hours when I stuck the thing on, because I couldn't believe my good fortune. Like, you know, my leg feels so powerful, and it's almost like my good leg, or my bad leg's my good leg now. The rest of my body needs to catch up to it. And I just felt a real debt. Like, they made the brace in the first place to help soldiers coming back, you know, from war who were potential amputee candidates. And this brace, this device, lets you keep your bad leg, but when you stick it on, you get to do things you couldn't do otherwise. Like,
that's crazy.
You don't get the swelling you would otherwise. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So hopefully anybody who hears about it and wants to consider helping another vet, it's runfreely.org.
That's fantastic.
Hey, everybody, don't forget to go to ESPN and Apple Podcasts and subscribe to That's What She Said with Sarah Spain so you always have the latest episode. Don't forget to rate and review it as well and tell all your friends how awesome it is.
You are headed to the Super Bowl to do a bunch of stuff again. I like a lot of the stuff you do that's even outside sports. I don't watch as often, but I used to be a loyal Dancing with the Stars viewer, and Dance Center is one of the funniest things I've ever seen. Was that as enjoyable for you to do as it was for me to watch? Because for those who don't know, it was sort of a Sports Center play in the middle of Dancing with the Stars where Kenny Mayne would talk about the other contestants and how they were faring and where their weaknesses were. And it was one of the funniest things ever. I just loved it.
Yeah. No, yeah, for those who really don't know, I was one of the contestants on Dancing with the Stars in its first season. They did a summer, like, trial show, but this was the first official fall season. And I didn't last long. I'd still contend I was better than Master P. Great guy. We got along well. But I thought I put out a greater effort and had more moves, but he had a bigger fan base. So I got voted off immediately. I lasted 90 seconds. And then they called back because, hey, we want to use you in the show somehow. We don't know how. And we just kind of conceived this ridiculous sports cast that, just like NFL shows, you know, break down the final four playoff teams. We would come on and break down the remaining dancers once they got toward the end of their season. So it was Jerry Rice, me, and Len Goodman, the judge.
So
and we
good.
Just did this. We would shoot for like 2 hours, and they'd find the best 7 minutes.
In full makeup and sparkles, and it was so good.
Well, that was the funniest part is Jerry Rice would get mad at me if I wouldn't apply enough glitter. Like, come on, man, you got to add more. You know, he'd get upset with me. So, yeah, sadly, they killed that because they went down to 1 a week shows instead of they used to go Monday, Tuesday. So they just had no place. I like to always correct when I make a mistake on SportsCenter later in the show, even if the bosses don't like bringing up mistakes. I think I spaced out. It was Jamal Crawford, Gary Payton, Jerry Rice, Steve Largent, and Lenny Wilkins. I think I left one of them out.
I think you had left Steve Young out, maybe, but either way, you got it now. Set. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the Dance Center stuff, you were in basketball.
Yes.
Drew Carey. Like
Dance Center's dead.
What's that?
Dance Center's dead. Let it go.
But I want to talk about the stuff you've done because as somebody who's into comedy, obviously, and has done full-on acting in commercials and TV shows and movies, is there ever a part of you that wants to do more of that full-time?
There's 100% part of me, if anyone's out there listening. Yes, I'm in. What do we want to do? When? I'm
right.
In.
Do you try? Are you trying to do that?
Also, I was in something and also not in something. You know, Trainwreck?
Yeah.
The
Amy Schumer?
Movie, a couple of Schumer and Hader and LeBron James.
Yeah.
So I got to shoot, and Tony Romo was in a scene as well. And they kept me out entirely. They gave me the sad call, how funny it was. It really played well in the room. All those good things they said. And I see where they were going. Like, while they worked, they also made no perfect sense in the, you know, the way they laid out the show. Like, it was just one more funny thing, but unnecessary. So I'm on the DVD extra, and I get little tiny checks every quarter. But
that's awesome.
I got killed. It was sad.
Of course.
I was looking forward, and it was such a fun experience. They called me literally like on a Monday, and they just dreamed it up. They were having coffee or whatever. Like, we got to add something else right in this section. And somehow they thought of me. And I said, I can do it, but only if you can fly my daughter as well, because I had my daughters that week, and one of them was away somewhere, but I had the other daughter, Riley. And they said, fine. So they literally, like, flew us the next day to New York, shot all day the next day after that. And then I found out, you know, 4 months later. Sadly,
yeah. My very first role in L.A. was an ESPYs commercial when I was trying to be an actress. And I told everybody that I knew I was going to be on TV, and then I never made the cut. So after that, I learned that you never tell anybody about something until it's fully done and you're sure you're in it.
Yeah. No, I didn't overpromise in that regard, but it was a sad day over here, even though he buttered me up. But no, I'm I'm always open for such things when they do arise. And I'm often pitching commercial ideas on my own. Like I said, if I can bat, like, you know, 128 for the year and still have a good year. I have very little pride about getting a no. it just means it didn't work that time. But you kind of have to put yourself out there. I don't have an agent.
Yeah, I was going to say, I know you don't. That seems like something, if you wanted to explore more acting or comedy or anything outside of the sports world, an agent would be someone who's constantly on, like, looking out for opportunities for you.
Yeah, if there are any agents who want to just do this on a kind of ad hoc basis, give me a call and tell me what deal you brought in, and we'll talk about that one. But now, for whatever reason, I don't know. I think I'm too hands-on, so I would always question, what the hell's going on? What did you do today? Who'd you pitch? What are you talking about?
Right.
And so maybe I was a little forceful in that sense. But, this isn't to disparage all agents. I'm sure many people who work in the arts have great agents. I never matched up with anybody where we just were in the right concert together, you know, to accomplish things. And I've done okay enough without one that I just haven't seen the need.
So when you look back at the projects you've done, and, you know, you loved all of them in the moment, which one would you most want to revisit and do it again, knowing what you know now?
Hmm. That's a good one. Can I have, like, 20 minutes on that?
Yeah, get back to us. We'll just wait. We'll play some music.
Yeah, just play something symphonic. Hold on. I wish I had done a better job with the Stevie Wonder experience. Because he truly, of everyone out there, he's the only one that I would ever use the word idol. And now that I've met him, you can't really say that because now I actually know him. I'm not, like, tight with him, but I think he'd remember me if we crossed each other again. I got him. I used to do the baseball all-star softball game, you know, the little thing they run on the They run it after the Home Run Derby. So for years, I was in that. One year, I couldn't make it for some reason, and then they never invited me back again. So that taught me a lesson.
Yeah, right. Never don't be available.
Year, don't say no one time.
Yeah.
So one year, we were going to, the game was going to be in Detroit. Stevie's from Detroit, from Saginaw. And I said, I think we have a way to include him if you guys will trust that I'm going to go down and acquire his services. So we had no plan. We had no connection. I didn't even have a press pass. I had nothing. And my boss, yeah, go for it. Sounds good. Try. Let's see what happens. So I appreciated that enthusiasm and his belief in me to pull it up. It was a concert in Philadelphia called Live 8, not Live Aid, but it was a bunch of musicians asking the G8 nations to relieve some African debt. A little complicated what they were after, but they were saying, let's raise money and raise awareness. Stevie Wonder's one of the artists playing in it. So I get down there, and I got this flimsy little pass. I don't know how I connected with the organizers, because it wasn't like a long known thing. You know, it kind of came up. And unfortunately, my pass let me in a tent about 9 blocks away from where the concert was. I wasn't going to get very close to Stevie Wonder. But as the day went on, I just kept getting upgrades. You know, I met this guy, and he got me here, and the next guy got me here. Pretty soon, I got a lanyard, and I'm literally standing backstage talking to Sarah McLachlan. So I'm doing better as the day goes on. Then I get near Stevie's trailer, and his handler keeps waving for people to come in, like Will Smith gets brought in, and Natalie Portman gets brought in, all these famous people. And he's looking right at me, waving, big smile. And I was like, they don't know who I am. Like, why would they be waving me to come to me? So I take a step forward, and just then Don Cheadle walks by me. Wrong guy. They were waving to him the whole time. So I'm still not close. However, I never quit. This is like a 15-hour effort. And hour 12, I find the right guy. He says, I'll let you talk to him after he's done singing. He'll either say yes or he says no. He said yes. And his line was, I can't be at the All-Star game. I have a high ankle sprain. Put 15 hours of work in for that line. I thought it was a pretty good line. So that part was good. He did it one take. He was very funny. He was charming. And then when I went to execute it on TV, I just did a bad job. I think I just started tripping that I'm talking about, I know Stevie Wonder and he met me and I don't know what I'm talking about. And
right.
Yeah. So of all the things I've done, I wish I had executed that better. But yeah. I don't know about any, like, huge opportunities that I did the wrong thing and blew it, or, you know, you never know.
I wonder, you know, you are somebody, because you're so dry and because you're so sarcastic and because you, as you said, are bored with convention, you drop a lot of things either on social media or even in sports centers or in pieces that you do that not everyone gets. And that's great as a comedian. It's frustrating to some people. I get really frustrated when people don't get the joke, especially when it's something I've always used it as an example of why it sometimes can be hard as a woman to try to be funny in a subtle way, because people just assume you're dumb because they don't give you the benefit of the doubt. Like if you start a segment with LeBron James warming up, never seen him play, I heard he's pretty good, everyone's going to be like, ha ha. And if I said that, they'd be like, this dumb doesn't know who LeBron James is, right? The difference in the way it's perceived. Does that annoy you when people don't get your stuff, or are you so uninterested in what other people think of you that you don't care whether somebody walks away from some great joke of yours and they're not equipped enough to understand it, so they leave thinking you're the idiot?
Well, first, I'm annoyed at the story you said, because I think there's some truth in that it's unfair that everyone isn't given equal status, equal foundation, you know, going into it. I don't know. I think I do, I guess in those moments, you do what you think me is funny or is going to work, and you just can't worry about the whole world. Like, and it's not to say I'm so smart. It's more, that's my take on whatever it is I'm commenting on. I think sometimes the best example of that is, we've shot commercials before where in the room, everybody loved, you know, this part, this part, this part. And then it goes to the final edit and you don't see any. It's like, why didn't you use the funny parts? It would have been funnier. And, well, not everybody would get it. So we kind of went a little more down the road. So that's unfortunate. But I don't know. I think you stick to your guns. I'll tell you, way back when you're talking about any mistakes you might have made or something that went awry, I did the ESPYs, New York City, God, it was 100 years ago. All I remember is Boogie Nights had come out recently, so whatever year that was, late 90s, I want to say. And they wanted Dan Patrick and I to pretend that we were upset with the guys who were on Sports Night, the ABC show, the Sorkin show, about the sports company,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Josh Charles and what's the other name? I know the name. You'll come up with it.
Sports Google. Night, right? Wasn't it Sports Night?
Yeah. I know. Sports Night.
Yeah. Just
right?
Like
Aaron Sorkin
show.
Was writing. He was writing whatever he was writing, and he kept staying up late watching SportsCenter, and he ended up, I'm going to develop a show about a sports channel. And it was, you know, obviously modeled after ESPN to some degree. So they had this skit where Dan and I were going to be so incensed that the Sports Night guys were kind of ripping us off, like stealing our good lines or whatever.
Right.
That they wanted us to hold guns and pretend that we were going to shoot them. And you'd see like the little, you know, the little red dot, little tracer thing. And I showed up for the rehearsal for it. I said, I don't know. You really want us holding guns? Like, is that funny that we might kill somebody over a joke? Or, you know, even though it's all a joke.
Right.
Don't we have a different joke we could do to show that we're mad? And by the way, they're just stealing his lines anyway. Am I, like, so taken by Dan that I'm going to kill for him? Like, there's a lot of layers.
Right.
So I just, like, I don't know if I like this. I don't think we should do this. So we had this little debate back and forth, producers, all these people, and they ended up with the alternative. They'll bring in some other guys in fatigues holding the guns, and we'll just be standing near them. And I was kind of like, it's still pretty bad. We're still,
it's still
in this
gun violence over a joke. Just now involving the military.
And I wasn't buying. Why would the company want us? It just didn't feel right. Even as a joke, it didn't feel right. So I keep protesting. They shoot the thing the way they wanted to shoot it. It runs, you know, it's on tape. So now the real ESPYs start rolling, and they run that little gag. Half the audience kind of laughs, half doesn't. It, you know, didn't go over that great. It wasn't horrible. But I'm like, pissed, because, like, I just hated being involved in the whole thing. So when it came time for me to go out to do my live performance, you know, Player of the Year, Women's College Basketball, something, I decided to go slightly off script, which meant entirely. Some would say it was funny. Some would say it was really abstract and not funny. And, you know, God knows what everybody thought of it in the end. I think I gave a clenched fist salute to my brothers from ESPN News who didn't get invited. We will bring you back shrimp from the post party. I think I threw that in there. So for some, they were like, so all this happens. Crowd's weirded out. And I come off stage and there's Burt Reynolds. And he says, dude, that was genius. I said, really? How come nobody laughed? And he said, don't worry. Yeah, I can't say what he said about the people, but you can imagine.
Right.
And blank them or something. And then he ended up writing like a note about sticking with your passion and believing in yourself and follow your
heart. That's awesome.
It was like this insanely amazing kind of surreal moment. Burt Reynolds is standing up for me, like, believe in yourself and don't let the people bring you down. Do you have time for an Uncle Gordy joke? Because it really relates to this.
Yeah, absolutely. Always.
So Uncle Gordy is the one who, my mom's brother, and he's the one who taught me horse racing. That's where I got my love of that growing up, from Long Acres, the old track near Seattle. Gary Stevens, Hall of Fame jockey, broke through there. The Bays family, anybody? So his joke was, they're at the Acme Dog Food Company convention, and the president's up there saying, we have the greatest marketing, we have the greatest sales staff, the greatest, you know, delivery system. And he's going on and on, you know, everybody's cheering and all these different units of the company getting their praise. He says, but why are sales down 8%? And the guy in the back, Peabody, raises his hand and says, it's those effing dogs. Yeah, that's not for everybody either. But to your point, you can't worry about everybody.
That's kinda true. The guy was You've saying. Proved that point perfectly.
Yeah, with a joke. I still stand by the...
You stand by the joke?
Yeah. What's our girl who called me on the phone originally?
Tarika?
How's she doing?
She's good. Yeah, we have to go to our final segment. Are you ready?
If you want.
Okay. You have to do the thing that everybody does, but nobody expects.
Didn't expect the kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
That's right. It's the 10 questions everybody gets and nobody expects. Number one, what's the natural talent you wish you were gifted with?
Singing.
Number two, desert island album. You can only have one.
Talking Book.
Who's that by?
Stevie Wonder.
Ah, oh, nice. Number three, if you could switch lives with anyone for a day, who would it be? Is that a drone?
That's a float airplane landing on Lake Washington.
Beautiful.
I'm going to take President of the United States.
Nice. Excellent. Would you like to explain why?
I would do a good job.
Number four, what's the most scared you've ever been?
Oh, there's a couple, but last summer in Greece, close to thinking there's a chance I might not get out of the water.
Oh, really?
A little panic. Yeah, it was bad. I'm a decent swimmer. Grew up on a lake, live, you know, like not horribly out of shape still, I think. I just kind of had a little panic attack. I sucked some salt water in, should have swam back to the boat. Instead, I tried to make it to shore. Next thing you know, a giant fairy sends these wakes and just started thrashing me. I'm like banging off rocks. I still wear the scars. I still bear the scars from that incident.
That
it
is
was
terrifying.
Scary.
That's really scary.
Yeah, that's just question four. I had to face death already.
Yeah, you already faced death. It gets worse from here. Number five, the most embarrassed you've ever been.
Countless. Gosh. Can we do a couple?
Yeah, go for it.
Sure. 95, Mariners, 15-inning game. Jim Leyritz hits a homer. The Mariners fall 0-2. They go back and win, right? They take down the Yankees in that playoff. Remember the Edgar Martinez? Good job, Hall of Fame. but I ask, there's like 25. You know how dorky sports reporters can be, period?
Yes.
Just admit it, right?
Yes, okay. Of course.
So there's like 25 dorky sports reporters. I'm sure some are great people. And I decide to ask Randy Johnson, did you think about getting up to warm up? I thought a legitimate question. The game's in the 15th inning. You know, you're going to go down 0-2. I know he's starting soon, either the next game or the one after. And he just looked at me like I was the biggest idiot ever. Like, that's just stupid. Or, you know, whatever he said. And it ended the little miniature press conference. Like, literally 25 other people lost all their chance at getting more questions because of me.
That's
I stand by my question because I think he did come in another ridiculous, you know, like sometimes they actually bring in a starter. What's another horrible? I think getting kicked off Dancing hurt. That was right up there, but, you know, it was a TV show, so you can't be that upset about it. I feel like I had another one. I know what it was. Early on in my sports casting in Seattle, we were doing the West Regionals were held in Seattle, and we didn't have IFB, that's a little thing in your ear where the director or producer can talk to you. We just had a guy named Maurice with cue cards on the floor. So there's no communication, and they rolled the wrong tape, and they didn't bail out of it. They just stayed with the wrong tape, and I got the wrong notes. It was like boom goes the dynamite. It was bad.
Yeah,
it was.
I would like to find that clip.
Yeah.
Not enough detail to find it, unfortunately. Number six, what would you consider your biggest failure?
God, what a downer this thing is.
It goes up again. Don't worry.
Biggest failure. I'd go back to college football. I got to go to school for free. It sounds good all these years later. You played, you know, Division I A and all that, but I didn't play that much. I could have been better. Like, I wish I had listened better. We had a great coach, Tony Knapp. He laid out this great offense, and he let you call your own plays. And since I was, like, the new guy coming in, second string, you know, I was trying to hit home runs and probably should have followed the system. Probably should have been a more system. I regret that I didn't do better in those years where I had so much opportunity potentially in front of me. Not that the other guys weren't good. Like I said, Sam led the nation in passing. Larry Gentry, the guy before, was good. But I kind of walk through that once in a while. Like, I wish I had that to do over again.
For sure. Number seven, what habit or quality do you think has contributed most to your success?
Perseverance, you know, just not worrying about the shame of getting a no or the embarrassment of trying something and failing. Like, no fear of failing, I guess, is the best. Like, I don't like to fail. I'd rather succeed, but it doesn't destroy me when I get a no, or it doesn't destroy me when something doesn't work out, because I just shoot for another angle at it.
Yeah,
there's
that's
another
a good fight. One. Number eight, have you ever been in a fist
sound.
Fight?
This is like an NPR story where they have the cool gnat sound.
Yeah, it sounds like you're on location somewhere very dangerous.
No more dangerous than that Greek swimming accident.
That's true. Have you ever been in a fist fight?
Honestly, I don't think as little, you know, like little six-year-olds wrestling and punching in the backyard. But the last true one I remember, because I remember this coming up. People were like, if you haven't been in a bar fight, you're not a real man or something. It's like, okay. I think it was seventh or eighth grade basketball, you know, wrestling for a ball and getting up and each shoving the other guy. But not a full, I'm going to meet you on the field after school and fight now.
Yeah, it's good. I'm proud of you. Number nine, the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve.
I'm thinking. Patience. I can be very impatient. I want stuff to happen when I want it to happen. Not in a total belligerent way, like yelling at people, but more, you know, I'm sometimes mystified why others can't see it my way. So I guess that's a lack of patience.
Right, for sure. And number 10, what three words would you most hope that people would use to describe you? Not necessarily a phrase, but the three words.
Can I add four?
Sure.
He has a heart. Is there a shorter way to say that?
No, I mean, you know, full of heart.
Yeah, we went to four. You know, like,
kind
toward other people. Like, yeah. I think that's something I definitely got from my dad. He was pretty simple, you know, worked regular job at the airport. You know, not somebody that, you know, I mean, like, doesn't have a claim for what he did or what he was. But everybody who ever talked about him just spoke about his goodness, you know.
Yeah.
And he always was big on inclusion. And growing up, you know, he worked with every color and every kind at the airport, and we'd have these parties. And it was a thing very early in our life, you know, to look at your fellow man equally, you know, not make judgments. So I love that I had that foundation from my parents that I think has been passed to my kids as well.
Yeah. Bonus question, who should I have on the podcast? Who's interesting that I should talk to?
Have you had Bill Walton?
I have not. That's a good one.
He's
a very good one.
He's interesting. I've used some of his emails as SportsCenter exclamations.
You know,
like,
I bet.
Like little things. Yeah, well, like I'll write him whatever I wrote him, and when he writes back, he's kind of doing it farcically, but also there's a sincerity about it. He's like, I have no business being on the same planet as you with your majesty and your goodness. You are kind, you know, like, I'm not even doing a good example,
yeah.
But one of them you just finished with, thank you for everything. Thank you for my life. So sometimes on a big shot, like somebody nails a half court shot, I'll just scream, thank you for my life.
I love that.
We had a little program going when I was going back to SportsCenter and I hadn't done it for a long time. I was telling friends and my daughters, Gretchen's daughter, you know, I'll pay $20 for any really good line that I can employ on SportsCenter.
That's awesome. That's a great idea.
I tried to tell Bill that I owed him money, and he said, give it to a good cause. He wouldn't take money.
That's great. Yeah, I'm going to have him. I'm so sad we didn't have enough time to get into politics. We'll have to do that next time.
Yeah, it's, well, we can extend. We can have stoppage time. No, we can't.
Thanks, Kenny. I appreciate it. You're
Thanks
the best.
For having me. It was fun, and you were interesting.
Thank you, as were you, and that's the goal.
Oh, and another thing.
This week's That's What She Read comes from one of my favorite columnists in Chicago, Heidi Stevens, who writes a column called Balancing Act. And she writes about all sorts of stuff. And in this case, she wrote about a topic that I had a connection to. Nora Leonard, who is the 16-year-old daughter of Kelly Leonard, a longtime executive at the Second City, whose podcast I had been on, was recently diagnosed with liver cancer that has since spread to her lungs. And as this 16-year-old, you know, fights these illnesses and gets support all over the entertainment industry, as Kelly and his wife continue to get everybody from Hillary Clinton to Jane Lynch to Stephen Colbert and Tina Fey to have signs that say Team Nora and support her. Kelly has been sharing on the Caring Bridge site for the hospital updates about his daughter. And he also recently discovered that he has a rare heart condition that has a leaky valve and an enlarged aorta. And eventually he's going to need surgery. It's not necessary right now, but he's going through this health issue at the same time that he's trying to help his young daughter. And it inspired him to write a blog post that then Heidi Stevens kind of co-opted and shared with some messages along the way. And I just want to read a little bit from it. I think it's really important right now. So remember, Nora is the daughter here. Nora told Anne that people keep saying how strong and brave she is, but she doesn't feel strong or brave. And as we enter our 6th month of this journey, the days are running into one another for her. When she can't mark them by school or games or performances or experiences other than those so directly centered on her illness or her wellness. Reflecting on what Nora was saying and what I'm currently feeling, especially given how many of you have sent messages of support, I find that our knee-jerk response when someone faces a health issue is empathy, as it should be, he wrote. We don't start with, well, he's a smoker, or, well, that family has a history of disease. Those comments may come up later, but it's never our first response. Our first response is to express care and solidarity and support. Isn't it interesting how that's the opposite muscle we flex in our political and cultural conversations in the country right now? Instead of leading with the outstretched hand, we lead with the clenched fist. And I'm not being Pollyannic. The fist might be the best way to respond, but shouldn't that hand be unclenched at the very first offering? Isn't curiosity or empathy a more appropriate initial response? So Heidi writes, it's a slower response. It doesn't let us make up our minds immediately about the weekend confrontation on the National Mall, the one where Indigenous rights activists and Hebrew Israelites and March for Life participants come face to face, the one very few of us were there for, but most of us have an opinion about. I don't think Leonard saying we shouldn't condemn bigotry or injustice, I don't think an outstretched hand has to mean a lack of moral certitude. I think the world feels out of control, and we're hungry for order and control, even if that means putting people in boxes where they don't quite fit. You can continue to read. It's really great. And I think there is some perspective to be had by understanding the ways in which we react and talk about things. And, you know, my next week's guest, actually, Shelley Smith, talks about how differently people treat her after her cancer diagnosis. We shouldn't require that of people. We shouldn't need that terrible twist in our lives to lead with compassion in the moments that maybe we don't have all the answers. So I highly recommend reading it. Again, it's Heidi Stevens, ChicagoTribune.com. The column is Balancing Act, and the headline is We Remain Confident We Have To, as Nora Leonard, 16, keeps up cancer fight. Her dad calls for cultural healing. Thanks, as always, for lasting about an hour with me.
That's what she said.